state workers may get a pay raise as early as July 1st. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us why this weekend's Republican State Convention could be a barn burner. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a forest expert about steps being taken to prevent the spread of bark beetles. Governor Steve Bullock and state employee unions say they have reached a deal on raises for public employees. The deal details how to split up $116 million provided by the Montana legislature for the raises. Lawmakers rejected a proposal from Bullock and the unions for a bigger pay increase. This would have given state workers a 5% pay hike each of the next 2 years. The smaller bill passed by legislators cut a quarter of the funding from the Bullock proposal, then sent it back to his office for renegotiation with unions. Eric Fever is president of the MEA-MFT, the largest state employee union. Fever says the raises will give a 3% raise to employees this year, starting in July, and another 5% raise in November 2014. He says that is the best deal that could be reached with the money they have.
Effectively, the effort that we put into this was to figure out how to distribute this money as broadly as possible to all state employees and to give them the greatest bang for the buck, if you want to look at it that way.
The plan also freezes any increases to out-of-pocket payments for state employee health insurance next year. The pay plan will now have to be ratified by each individual state agency and the unions. The raises will be the first base pay increases for state employees in more than 4 years.
The state has opened a medical clinic in Billings for workers and their families covered by the state's employee health plan. Lee Newspapers of Montana reports the clinic opened this week and is available to about 2,000 state employees and their dependents. This is staffed by a physician, a half-time nurse practitioner, and two wellness coaches. A clinic that opened in Helena last August is available to 11,000 state employees and their families. Former Governor Brian Schweitzer proposed the clinics in 2012 as a way to reduce employee health costs through managed care. Healthcare and Benefits Division Administrator Russ Hill says the state hopes to open clinics in Miles City and in either Butte, Anaconda, or Deer Lodge to serve state employees there. The clinics are operated by Care Here of Brentwood, Tennessee.
And in other news from around the state, a frozen berry mix sold at Costco is being recalled after being linked to hepatitis A. Townsend Farms is recalling the organic antioxidant blend frozen berry mix that was sold in Costco stores across Montana. The product has been linked to at least 49 hepatitis A illnesses in 7 states. Costco is advising that those consumers who purchase the Townsend Farm frozen berry mix not eat any of it and that they discard any of the unused products. Consumers that purchase the products may contact Costco for a refund. Although hepatitis A can cause severe illness, nearly all who become ill do recover. A full listing of affected products can be found on the Food and Drug Administration's website at fda.gov.
Former state legislator Ryan Zinke of Whitefish says he may consider a U.S. Senate run if Montana Republican Party's big names don't get in the race. The ex-Navy SEAL has been the focus of a recruitment effort by a political action committee that seeks out veterans for higher office. Interest in the race has sharpened since six-term U.S. Senator Max Baucus announced his retirement. Zinke calls himself a blue-collar Republican who wants to stand up for all workers and believes, quote, government stops at the mailbox, unquote, when it comes to social issues. Zinke said today he is waiting to see if U.S. Representative Steve Daines or former Governor Mark Roscoe enter the Republican primary. Democrats say they are waiting to see if former Governor Brian Schweitzer enters the race.
Montana's Republican faithful are preparing for their annual convention in Bozeman this Friday and Saturday. The state GOP will be choosing new party leadership and rallying their supporters to gear up for the long 2014 election cycle. But Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says a growing division in the party threatens to overshadow the event.
An increasingly public split has been forming between hardline conservatives and a group of moderates branding themselves responsible Republicans. The division became more and more apparent through the course of the 2013 legislature, with the moderates breaking away from GOP leadership to side with Democrats on many of the session's key issues, like pay increases for state employees, a fix to state retirement plans, and public school funding. State Republican Party Chairman Will Deshaw says no one side of this split will be emphasized over the other at this weekend's convention.
What we can do is try and talk about unity. And I intend to do that over the weekend. Talk about how we have to start respecting one another.
Well, the The issue is, what message are we going to unite behind?
That's Billings Republican Senate President Jeff Essman, one of the leaders of the conservative wing of the legislative GOP.
You know, are we going to unite behind an agenda of greater personal freedom and smaller government? Are we going to unite behind a message of, let's just make the big government we've got more efficient?
Essman says recent privacy scandals involving the Obama administration show the increasing size of government is limiting personal freedoms. Kalispell Republican Senator Bruce Tutvet, though, he believes most Montana Republicans align more with the philosophies he and the other so-called responsible Republicans worked to pursue this past session. He says those ideals could help Republicans win more statewide races.
The other team says you go to the 8% and you build from your base of the 8%, the far right. And I think that's wrong. I think you build, and you build at the middle, and you find what that middle voter that gets you from 45 to 52%.
Tutvet and a group of the moderate Republicans earlier this week unveiled a website called StopDarkMoney.com. The site is intended to raise awareness for a ballot measure the group is proposing to require more disclosure of anonymous campaign advertising. Tutvet admits this was a strategic shot at the conservative Republicans, some of whom he believes align with these anonymous political action committees to attack moderates during election season.
Well, part of the party that wants to hide in the dark, the people that attacked me in the primary, they don't want to have their donors released. We think they're large out-of-state donors. Do we want our party to be bought and paid for by out-of-state anonymous donors? And I think not.
Senate President Essman points out Democratic dark money groups are spending a great deal of money, too, in elections. And Essman says candidates need to be prepared to hear criticism.
Whether the donors of the effort to criticize you are disclosed or not, the criticism's going to be there, and you better be prepared to deal with it and explain yourself and your votes.
Party Chairman Will Deshaw, he's the guy who was calling for unity earlier. He's running to be reelected as party chairman against two opponents, Gary Carlson of Victor and Don Hart of Bozeman. Deshaw says he will not be trying to specifically court one side of this ideological split or the other during the convention. He's trying to frame what he calls this discussion in a positive light.
And I use it as an example, a married couple. They have an argument and don't talk about it. It gets bigger and bigger and festers more and more and more. So the fact that we are even talking about it is healthy, and we will get through this.
Republicans will also be hearing from party leaders like Congressman Steve Daines during the convention, who will also need to find a way to ride this line between these disparate sides. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Governor Steve Bullock has declared a state of emergency in 15 northern Montana counties and the Rocky Boy and Fort Belknap reservations because of widespread flooding. Those areas have received near record amounts of rainfall in recent days. The Chippewa Cree tribe estimates that flooding has caused between $1 million and $2 million in damage on the Rocky Boys Indian Reservation. The tribe declared a flooding disaster after six roads were washed out and dozens of homeowners reported flooded basements and interior damage from leaking roofs. The Great Falls Tribune reports six additional homes were without water after a line break along Box Elder Creek. Water Resources Division head Jay Eagleman says tribal officials are devising a strategy to reroute drinking water to those homes.
Missoula officials hope to break ground after a new emergency soup kitchen and homeless shelter this fall. The current Pavarello Center has seen an over 400% increase in the people it serves since it first opened in 1981. The new $5 million center on West Broadway will offer both more room and more services for the 100 men and women who stay at the shelter on average every night. Executive Director Aaron Fowler-Pahan says local, state, and federal dollars are helping with the cost, plus they have raised over $1 million from the private sector. They still need to raise $500,000 to reach their goal.
Our organization builds hope for men and women every day. We are the safe haven in this community for people who fall in hard times and find themselves homeless or living in poverty without food resources. And so sometimes that very basic first step of moving on to the next best option is having access to those basic needs of food and shelter.
Officials are holding a formal kickoff of their Help Build Hope fundraising campaign at this hour in the Governor's Room of the Florence Hotel. People who want more information about the new shelter and how to donate can go to this website, thepavarellocenter.org. We'll have a feature interview with Pei Han about Missoula's homeless population tomorrow during Montana Evening Edition.
The anti-trapping organization is proposing a ballot initiative for 2014 that would ban animal trapping on public lands in Montana. The Secretary of State received the proposed initiative Monday from Footloose Montana Board President Timothy Provo. The Legislative Service Division is renewing the proposal. A similar initiative failed to get enough signatures to make it on the ballot in 2010. Footloose Montana spokeswoman Casey York says there has been increased public awareness since then that trapping is inhumane and can injure or kill non-targeted animals. She says the proposal is reasonable because it would not affect trapping on private property. Montana Trappers Association spokesman Toby Walruth says trapping is necessary to sustain and maintain certain species. He says it is a part of Montana's culture and many families depend on trapping.
An endangered river designation and plans for mine expansion north of the border are prompting concern downstream in Montana. The Elk River in Canada runs into Lake Coconusa and the Kootenai River system. The river recently made headlines after being identified as one of the most endangered rivers in British Columbia. Fisheries biologist Jim Dunnigan with Fish, Wildlife, and Parks out of Libby says one of the downstream effects of mining is an increase in selenium in the water.
Selenium at high levels becomes problematic, especially for the species of fish, because it impacts their reproductive capacity.
Dunnigan says in Lake Coconusa, burbot or ling are the fish they're seeing high levels of selenium, causing concern. FWP is hosting a public informational session in Libby tomorrow with a panel to present information and answer questions. Dunnigan says FWP will have an aquatic pollution biologist talking about the amount of selenium found in fish tissue samples from Coconusa. A representative from the State Department of Environmental Quality will be there to talk about water, sediment, and fish monitoring in the lake. Representatives from Tech Coal will also be there to talk about what the industry is doing in the long term to address the situation.
This is purely an informational meeting to provide some information to people about the situation and what's being done, not only to monitor but to address the situation in the long term.
The event starts at 2 tomorrow afternoon at the Libby City Hall.
As we reported yesterday, the Beaverhead Deer Lodge National Forest will soon begin applying insecticides in popular recreation areas. In tonight's feature interview, the Beaverhead Deer Lodge Reforestation Forester Bruce Schulke tells Edward O'Brien the sprayings necessary to protect valuable areas that could be threatened by the mountain pine beetle.
We have been kind of the epicenter for the mountain pine beetle outbreak in Montana for the last 7 to 8 years. On the 3.3 million acres of forest, we've got about 1.5 million acres that the mountain pine beetle are affecting. Anywhere from killing 80 to 90% of the trees in an area down to areas that are only about 20 to 30% affected right now.
Geez, Bruce, how come? What's going on?
Well, you know, the trees are at that perfect age and diameter that the mountain pine beetle likes. They like trees from 8 inches in diameter on up. They like trees that are 80 years of age or older. And they like trees that are at the elevation of the forest right now. The other thing that has kind of set us up for a mountain pine beetle epidemic is the dry summers that we've had and the low moisture in the wintertime. The lodgepole pine is stressed because of the density of the stands. And so the mountain pine beetle comes in and they can actually smell that stressed effect that the trees are experiencing and go in and start eating into the trees and burrowing in and affecting the trees.
And on top of it all, we haven't had any bitter cold winters in the past few years, yeah?
Exactly. The mountain pine beetle can overwinter very easily in our winters, but once we have temperatures of minus 34 degrees and that minus 34 has to exist for 3 or 4 days in a row, that will actually kill the mountain pine beetle that are overwintering in the trees. But, you know, we haven't had those kind of temperatures since about 1991, 92, 93 in there. You know, I remember driving over. I used to commute back and forth from Butte to Phillipsburg, where I used to work, and one morning I got there, and the guy said, "What are you doing here?" And it was minus 52 that morning. And it actually had killed a small mountain pine beetle outbreak that started in the Delmo Lake area at that time, and that cold temperature snap kind of wiped that out. And it kind of put it back into an endemic stage where we have a small population always in the forest, but they are only taking out a tree here and there. But they've grown, they've expanded, you know, warm winters and that, they could keep expanding. And here we are today with, you know, a million plus acres of dead lodgepole sprinkled throughout, and mountain pine beetle are enjoying their desserts.
And what's the rate of this devastation? Is it slowing down at all or not?
Well, the Butte area has slowed down. Actually, we kind of got some news over the winter from our mountain pine beetle aerial detection group that told us that the mountain pine beetle became a little bit more active in the Butte area over the last year. That kind of surprises us because we've been eaten out of house and home, but there's a couple of trees here and there that they're finding and taking those out too. So it's not over in the Butte area. They are still here with us, but they're expanding into the Big Hole, the scenic byway area. They're starting to slop over into the Phillipsburg area, the Pintlers, Pioneers. They're moving, I guess, what I would have to say, west and south a little bit on us. They've eaten out the Jefferson and the Butte districts to a large extent.
So it sounds like the Beaverhead Deer Lodge then is taking efforts to slow this spread in certain areas, yes?
Yeah, you know, we can't treat the whole forest. Too expensive. And so what we have elected to do on the forest is to treat specific areas, i.e. campgrounds, administrative sites, that have large recreational values to them, that we are spraying individual trees in those campgrounds to keep green trees on those sites that we feel are most used recreation sites on the forest, that if we let the mountain pine beetle attack, would create a high hazard condition because most of the trees would be dead. We'd have to clear cut those campgrounds and then start regenerating them back. And in certain campgrounds, we have lost the battle, and Beaver Dam Campground being one of those on the forest, and there are others. And then there are others where we've put a good fight up and we have saved a significant amount of trees, and those in particular are the Georgetown Lake campgrounds, and we have others sprinkled across the forest that we've been successful in fighting the mountain pine beetle.
Tell us then about these treatments that are planned.
Well, we are using a product, 7XLR Plus, that we actually use. It's a carbaryl product. We actually have to spray the boles of the trees, and we are treating those trees mainly 8 inches in diameter and up, and we actually saturate the bole of the tree with the chemical by spraying the bole of the tree. We actually close the campground while we're treating those trees, and then that chemical is good on the tree for up to 2 years. We don't have to go back in for 2 years to the campground to retreat and reprotect those trees.
There may be listeners out there who are concerned about the impacts this chemical will have on human, wildlife, and waterway health. What should they know?
Well, you know, we've done an environmental analysis, and we have certain things that we do have to do to protect the public and to keep safeguards in place. We can't spray near open water. We cover all the campgrounds and the restroom facilities, drinking fountains and that, with plastic so the chemical does not get on those. And then the chemical, once we apply that, is very hard for for the public to be affected by. On the vegetation, it breaks down quickly, but what's unique about the chemical then is when it's attached to the bark of the tree, it actually stays active. So if a beetle starts chewing on the bark, it will actually ingest that chemical and be affected by the chemical.
Those hormonal packets will be used as well?
Yeah, they're called anti-aggregant pheromone packages, and what they actually do is they mimic the mountain pine beetle's chemical that they produce when a mountain pine beetle attacks a tree. After a certain amount of those mountain pine beetle are into a specific tree, the beetle then sends what is it called an anti-aggregant pheromone off, a scent that says, guys, you don't need to come here and attack this tree anymore. You can hit other trees that there are not enough beetles affecting. With the large epidemic populations that we do have of the beetle right now, the anti-aggregant pheromone is less effective because the population is so large that they're just hitting almost every tree.
Huh. Okay, regarding the carbaryl spraying, when does, kind of a three-parter here, when does it start, under what conditions, you know, weather circumstances, and how can the public find out more about when and where?
Yeah, we have been trying to start spraying around the 10th of June. We have sent out information to the newspapers of what campgrounds are going to be affected. The public can actually call the district office of the district that they're looking at potentially a campground and using for that weekend or week and see if that campground is planned to be treated that week. Our spray program is affected by rain. We cannot be applying the chemical during a rain event or when the trees are wet or when there's still standing water in the campgrounds. And right now, we have still some standing water in the campground, so we're monitoring those on a daily and a weekly basis to make sure that those campgrounds are dry before we go in to spray. Once those campgrounds have dried out, we start spraying in them. We have to close them. And right now, we are trying to spray only Monday through Thursday. It's a real balancing act because we get blown out by rain. If the winds get high, we have to stop until the winds get low enough to where our chemical isn't drifting. We're being really careful with our product to make sure we are creating the safest possible conditions for the public out there.
Last question, and that is, we opened talking about the extensive infestation of the bark beetle on the Beaverhead Deer Lodge. Bruce, is this a losing battle?
To keep somewhat green trees in our campgrounds, it's not a losing battle. You know, across the forest, because of the large-scale epidemic that we have, it is just trying to treat areas that we, either through logging to create safe areas or to reduce the amount of wood that's going to fall on the ground and over time be a fuel hazard for fires, the beetles are going to take their natural course, and we can't do anything about that but protect those highly valued areas the way we are currently doing on the forest. So losing battle, I'd say that no, we're putting up a battle where we need to and want to keep highly valued areas. And the other areas, you know, the beetle are going to take out what they're going to take out. And that's why we've elected just to protect our highly valued areas.
Been speaking with Bruce Schulke, reforestation forester for the Beaverhead Deer Lodge National Forest. Bruce, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
And in tonight's weather forecast, across our entire listening area tonight, expect partly cloudy skies. Tomorrow also calls for partly cloudy skies with temperatures around 70 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Mary Sheehy Moe.
This week across Montana, school children are scampering off to what they hope is endless summer. Meanwhile, their teachers close another chapter in their careers. For some of them, it's the last chapter. But whether it's the first, middle, or last time, the closing of the school year is a bittersweet time for our K-12 school teachers. School teaching is a profession like no other. You live in the high-intensity world of children and adolescents, a world full of kid dramas that most of us have blissfully forgotten. The loneliness of the new kid, the spats between cliques of girls, the mortification over the too short haircut, the anxiety before the first solo, the disappointment of missing that last shot on goal. As the only adult in their world, the teacher is keeping a simmering cauldron of childhood emotions from boiling over pretty much all the time. A teacher's world is a restricted one. Unlike other professions, even something as simple as using the bathroom can only happen at certain times, which is why teachers have the greatest bladder control of all professionals. Unlike other professions, there's no flexibility in teachers' schedules, and they're pretty much confined to their workplace all day. No Rotary Club luncheons for them. No 30-minute walk after lunch. No putting off that unpleasant task until your energy level is higher. Ask not for whom the bell tolls. Teacher, it tolls for thee. And like thy students, thou best be in thy classroom by the time it stops. For the same reasons, interactions with other adults are also pretty limited. So over time, most school teachers work and socialize primarily with other school teachers. It takes a conscious effort to broaden your circle of professional and social acquaintances, and your odd schedule works against it. Unlike other professions, you don't have one client at a time to provide services for. You have 20, 30, or 150 at once, all with different personalities, different abilities, different needs and circumstances. It can be overwhelming for them and for you. And unlike other professions, you don't meet with these clients once a week or month for an hour or two. You're with them every day, sometimes all day long. At school, they are your world and you are theirs. So much so that when they see you in a setting outside of school, the grocery store, the mall, they stare at you as bewildered as if you've been transported from the planet Krypton. And of course, most jobs don't have these annual openings and closings of a chapter. First days when you meet a whole new set of clients who will populate your world all year, and last days when you say goodbye to them pretty much forever. So the last days of school are bittersweet. Yes, there's relief to have a little while off to rest, rethink your strategies, and refill that reservoir of enthusiasm and energy you need to teach. But there's also a sense of loss as these children you've come to know and care about go on to the next phase of their lives without you. 18 years ago, I took my then-teenage daughter, Ellen, to the film Mr. Holland's Opus. She got a sense of the teaching world she didn't get from me, a sense of those chapters opening and closing year after year, until finally the last chapter comes and you turn the last page in the book that has absorbed you your entire adult life. Ellen got a sense of the lives that a teacher touches. The girl who couldn't play the clarinet but grew up to be governor. The boy who finally got the beat but later got killed in Vietnam. She got a sense of the fulfillment that comes from touching all of those lives. Like me, she was moved by the final scene when hundreds of students whose lives had been changed by Mr. Holland came back to reassure him that though his position had been cut, his life's work mattered. He had intended to be a composer, not a teacher, but he could only work on composing in between teaching tasks. He had a finished symphony, but had never seen it published, never seen it performed. He was too busy teaching. In an auditorium crowded with his former students, the clarinet-playing governor reminded him, "We are your symphony, Mr. Holland. We are your opus." As we left the theater, Ellen turned to me and said, "Is that what teaching is really like, Mom?" "Yes," I told her. "All but the last scene. Don't expect that kind of send-off." No, most teachers don't get an auditorium full of admiring parents and kids saluting their impact as they close their careers. There is no symphony in the final act, but they are keenly aware of the symphony being played in their classrooms all along the way. There's harmony in seeing that the lonely kid has friends now. There's a grace note when the girl who runs with the mean girls finds new ways to feel valued and valuable. There's the thrill of this one's crazy taste in clothes and that one's uncanny ability to imitate you. There's a crescendo of growing talent as all those different personalities become accomplished at all those different things. And there's the soaring feeling that while you didn't write this symphony, for a little while you get to direct it. As this school year ends, great teachers all across Montana are looking back at another year and thinking of the lessons they've taught and learned from their kids. and they're whistling a happy tune. There really is no other profession like it. This is Mary Shihimo, retired, but still proudly and happily a public school teacher at heart.
Mary Shihimo is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. Views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetich. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.